Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vow, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director of the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Jack. Doing just fine. Glad to see you. How are you doing?
I am good. I'm good. No complaints yet.
Good. You're feeling better.
You'll be the first to know.
Good. I know you were feeling a little under the weather a couple of weeks ago, but you're kind of out of that now. That's good.
Yes. Rebounding is always fun.
Oh.
Except when you're dating.
But it's also rough to try and catch up with all the things that you've been missing and doing, huh?
The other place I teach at, my first day back, teachers and students were like, never do that again. Did you ever leave us again? I'm like, all right. Sorry.
That's nice to be loved. I know how that is. That's great.
How dare you get sick?
Last time we talked about the definition of the moral imagination, which we were talking about being the foundation for a truly conservative position.
Yes.
Since we've been arguing about things from of the left once in a while, I thought it'd be good to clarify for our listeners what we mean by conservatism, because you know, nowadays, the word conservative is kind of a...
meaningless.
Well, meaning or worse. I mean, like it has a negative connotation to it with a lot of people.
Or it means the opposite of what it actually means.
Uh-huh. Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. We don't want to be under the charge of speaking conservatives and people like... Because I think I said in last podcast, you know, moral imagination is one of those things that get thrown around and conservative circles, and you get a lot of like amens and like sagacious nods from people. But
yeah.
If you're outside those circles and use that term, you know, it would be helpful to know how to explain it to somebody who doesn't understand what that means. Like, what do you mean a moral? You mean I'm only allowed to imagine certain things that are right and versus wrong? Is that what you mean? And so on and so forth, which is not what it means. But so it's good to unpack these things carefully.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I think we were in the middle of talking about it. I had an ideal notion that we could get through all four of them in one podcast, and it turned
out we hubris.
But we got through two of them. We talked about the first two.
Yeah, so basically you broke down moral imagination under 4 points.
Right.
The first one having to do with we originally called it fallenness, but we switched and said it's the flaw. Like there's a hamartia, a fallenness, a brokenness, a flaw at the heart of the human person.
Right.
That sort of prevents them from being what they ought to be and always messes up their own plans. I said it's a fundamental disjointment at the heart of the human person, and that disjointment is insurmountable. You can't get around it. You can't fix it by legislation and so on and so forth.
That's right. That's right. And it makes for a kind of tragic understanding of life.
Right, which was the second point.
Which, that's right. The tragic sense of life kind of comes out of the sense that the human being is a fallen person, and that on his own he can't save himself. He can't figure out how to do everything properly in order to accomplish the good that his heart would like to see accomplished. Yeah. But that means then that all of the endeavors of our life are, each of the endeavors of our life is flawed as well, right? So that we can't assume that anything we put into practice, any kind of system we create or any kind of organization or law or government or church, for that matter, is going to do everything perfectly. And that could be kind of discouraging.
Yeah.
Right? If you think about it that way. Except... just like with the law, you learn very quickly that you can't fulfill the law fully, and the only alternative is to throw yourself on the mercy of the court, as it were, on the mercy of God, and He in the kindness of kindnesses says, "I will accomplish for you what it is that needs to be accomplished." So we have that substitutionary atonement in theology that makes it possible for us to do things that are worthwhile and good and so on. And so that if we assume that we can do these things on our own, then it would be a more utopian approach to life. But it's also kind of misguided because the reality is we can't, can we?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you're bringing in the idea of redemption and atonement. But these two first principles, the first one being about the flaw I guess we could call it imperfectibility. Like mm-hmm. human beings are not perfect. Nothing they do is perfect. It's always going to break somehow. And then the thing that was attached to that, the second point, tragedy, that suffering is part of life. And if you put those two things together, you get an anti-utopian kind of mindset.
That's right.
We cannot save ourselves. Because of our imperfectibility and the tragic nature of life, we can't save ourselves by hook or crook, by legislation, even by religious devotion. But we also looked at them and saw how there's actually a Christian critiquing and understanding of those things, whereas a moral imagination may say imperfectibility, a Christian would say fallenness, which is a different sort of thing. It is a fundamental flaw that breaks our things, but there's a possibility of redemption.
Right.
Which is why I suggested that for tragedy, a Christian might throw in, wouldn't abandon tragedy, but it would throw in the idea of romance instead, which has tragic stuff in it because a lot of bad things can happen because of the flaw of the hero that is redemptive.
Right.
You know, things go wrong, but then by grace and providence, things go right.
Like Peter Lighthart's deep comedy.
Right. There's something deep. Tragedy is not negated. It's just it's given its proper place.
Right.
Its place
right.
is not the deepest thing.
Right.
Right. That Christianity elevates the comedy as above tragedy, as the highest art form.
That's what I think even the idyllic imagination would like to have, mm-hmm. but wants to have somehow autonomously. And you can't accomplish it that way as much as you might want to. And so the real crux of the whole thing is the question of who gets to decide who's in charge, who's going to run the show. And that takes us right back to the garden and to the third chapter of Genesis where the alternative was to obey God or not to obey God. To obey God and trust that he could teach us what right and wrong is, or to eat the fruit of the tree, the knowledge of good and evil for ourselves, ingest that ourselves, as it were, and end up being our own judge of what's good and evil.
Yes.
And as long as I'm my own judge, I have all the desires still in my humanity for happiness, for kind of heaven, kind of ceasing of suffering, and so on. But those things actually can't be accomplished, like I said a minute ago, by way of my own sort of wisdom. And what by extension, this means that the systems that we create, we have to assume are going to be flawed. They're going to be they're going to fall short somewhere. And we shouldn't be surprised by that.
Right.
You know, I think the utopian mind leads one to be it's very optimistic in the sense that, oh, we can accomplish this on our own. All we got to do is pull ourselves up, bring our joint, minds together and accomplish these things on our own. And all that, it's going to work out eventually. That's a kind of optimistic thing. But what it really leads to is a critique of everything. Because nothing is ever flawless.
Yeah.
And as long as it has a flaw, it's got to be thrown out and developed and perfected and so on. And so you find yourself being unable to be satisfied with anything in this world.
Yeah. The idyllic imagination is like the opposite or the counterpoint to a moral imagination.
Right.
So whereas the moral imagination sees imperfectibility, that we're fundamentally flawed and that flaw is insurmountable and it's part of the tragic nature of life.
Right.
We have to accept it. The idyllic imagination starts with human beings are fundamentally good and that it's systems that mess them up, or human beings are blank slates that can be made good if we just have the right systems in place.
That's right.
And so an idyllic imagination doesn't see life as fundamentally tragic. It sees great potential for the comic, but the comic that's not from redemption, but from, the pluck and ingenuity of the hero overcomes the obstacles and reaffirms the human spirit and, those things on the faith and humanity restored,
Right.
It's more like that, which is why maybe I would say Christianity holds to a romance and not just a strict.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. I like your word romance, because I think a true medieval romance is a story where you can make the wrong choice. And there are dire consequences for that wrong choice. It's not like everything is going to work out regardless. You may end up going through some pretty darn hard things. Mm-hmm. But But the possibility is there because of the fact that you can choose and you can learn and you can grow and do better, then you can be finally home in the end. You can finally find the love that you're longing for and the peace that you're longing for and so on. Mm-hmm. And that makes for a great story.
It really does.
If you have a story that doesn't allow for the wrong choices, it's not anywhere near as profound, is it, a story?
Yeah, it isn't. So those are the first two.
Right.
Right? Imperfectibility or fallenness, tragedy or romance, if you want it. The other two principles, which we're going to try and get to today, see how well our hubris holds up. The third one was the idea of community, and the fourth one was the idea of religion.
So right.
Let's start with community. What is, in the moral imagination's consideration, what does this principle of community mean?
Great. I think everybody on both sides of this equation would like to have community. But the moral imagination teaches that community has a particular definition, and that is not only the generation that you're living in now, but those who went before you and those who will come after you, those who are yet unborn, are going to be part of your community. So you have in your mind, you're constantly aware of what's gone on before, where you came from, who you came from, the shoulders on whom you stand, mm-hmm. which you stand.
You know, the bones that salt the earth beneath you. Kind
of. Right, exactly. Whereas I think the idyllic imagination has this notion, this sort of what they call progressivism, which is I know that the past is not as good as the future. That is, the past, that today is the best day that we've ever had. And so tomorrow is going to be even better. So in a sense, I don't have any reason to look to the past. The past is when they did it wrong, you see. Mm. I need to look at least to today, if not also to the future only. And so my community is made up mostly of people who are striving with me today and here. But I'm actually kind of rejecting or at least making unnecessary all those who have gone before. Mm-hmm. So the moral imagination insists that we are a part, we are a link in a chain, a much longer chain and a much more profound chain made up of those who've gone before and those who are going to be the result of our births in our generation.
So this idea of community is a specific one. It's a, what you call it, generational community.
Right. And the church talks this way. You know, the church is made up of the church triumphant and the church militant. Mm-hmm. And the church triumphant, of course, is those who have died already. They've gone through life and they've triumphed. But the church militant are those that are actually fighting the battle in life now. But we are connected to one another, so we should be. It was thinking of St. Paul and Dante and Augustine and so on as our brothers in the community. That makes for some very specific reasons for reading good books, right? Old books. Let me say that again. There, it makes for some very good, what am I trying to say? Gives a very good foundation. Let me start with a real sentence. That makes for a very good foundation for education and a purpose for education because you need to know who it is that went before, and the way to do that, of course, is to read their books. You can't very well know much about the future because they haven't been born yet. They haven't written any books. So the best way to get outside of your own
bubble. Prejudices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your own sort of provincialism.
Okay.
There's a kind of chronological provincialism that goes along with the idyllic imagination, and you need to break out of that. So that's why here at the center, and that's why liberal arts education has always been important, because we need to read those who've gone before us.
That's how Northrop Frye put it in The Educated Imagination. He said that's what an education is for, is to break you out of your provincialism.
Makes a lot of sense.
And give you a larger, wider vision of human experience.
That's right.
Anyways.
That's right.
This idea of community is a big deal today. It gets touted a lot, all right, these days. There is a I don't know how to describe it. Let's say there's a craving or a hunger for the idea of community. You know, people talk about, in the church we hear this a lot, but I mean, the terminology gets used in secular spaces as well. The idea of like, let's do life together, you know, or, you know, you can't speak into somebody's life until you are in community with them. You know, this idea of like, you know, there's more authority from somebody inside a group than somebody who's outside a group sort of like shouting at them, so to speak.
Interesting thought.
The intellectual side of it is basically saying this is a reaction to like years and years and years of individualism, of the idea and of technology facilitating individualism, you know. And by technology facilitating individualism, I'm thinking even things like cars, okay?
Sure.
The ability to go tens and tens and tens of miles in a matter of minutes, whereas before that it may have taken you hours.
Sure.
And thus limited your expansion. It's a big transformation and definitely can break up communities and can break up homes, and like kids can leave and go far away and there's no sense of like generational home building or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of like a family, five or six generations living in the same house and they slowly build on it every generation sounds very, well, maybe not quaint. Maybe it sounds very romantic, you know, like that. But it definitely doesn't seem normal. It almost seems like the norm is the kids leave and, of course, their job or their schooling or their something is going to take them some distance away.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to use holidays to, like, get back together.
Right.
There's a, intellectually, they'd say that it's a reaction against individualism and a desire to, like, reestablish this idea of community, right? It's often a slapdash affair because everybody wants community, but they want it on their terms. You know, they want to like, oh gosh, what is it? I remember Roger Scruton often critique a lot of the modern desire for community because they said they wanted membership without obligations. Right?
Right.
I want to be in
strings attached.
You know, I want to be in community with you, but I don't want any strings attached. I don't want any obligations put on me, like I have to act one way or the other. I don't have to be this, that, or the other. Or I get to tell you things, but I don't want you telling me things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I go into community with you so I can speak into your life, but if you're trying to speak into my life, well, you're being oppressive and, and you're being, well, who are you to tell? There's a, right. a deep-seated individualism doesn't want to leave entirely because we still want our, you know, to be ourselves and not be at the behest of others.
Right.
But we are communal creatures. Right, we are made in the image of a God who is in his essence Trinitarian. I mean, in his essence, he's one. But anyway,
right.
can't talk about the Trinity for longer than 2 minutes without falling into heresy. My point is, he's Trinity, right? So he is, in some mysterious sense, a community, so to speak, in himself.
Has been throughout eternity.
And we're made in the image of that. Even Aristotle said that man is a political animal. And what he meant by that is not that we like to go, like, form
Vote a lot.
We like to form voting blocks or ideological parties or something like that.
Right.
What he meant was is we form communities. We naturally form communities that aren't just based purely on instinct and intuition. We rationally reflect on organizing the community as well.
That's right.
Which is, he saw reason and rational reflection as essentially a part of what makes us human. So we are communal creatures. We desire and crave community at the same time. And the moral imaginations talk about community just seems to say speak that not that you desire community or even that you are essentially communal, you know, it would admit both those things, but it's almost like a deeper principle that whether you like it or not, you are already in community. Like your reality is community. You are in community with those who have gone before and you have no say in who went before. And you are in community with those who come after you, and in some sense you have no say on that part. I mean, you may not have kids, but other people are having kids, and you have no say what those kids are going to be or what they're going to be like. And even the kids you have may not be, you may, you know, for the parents in the room, you may have way more limited say in who they're going to be than you think they have. And so it's this idea that you're already in community, all right?
Right.
And community in human life is a given of human life. And it's one of those things you ignore at your peril. Just like if you ignored gravity, which is a given of like a mass or something like that, you ignore gravity at your peril. So you ignore that generational communalness at your peril.
And even if you find that you don't have children or you haven't had children yet, everybody has parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are connected that way generationally.
Yes.
We can't get around it. We didn't create ourselves. In fact, one of the great spots, I think, to start an apologetics work in the heart of a of an unbeliever is to say, you didn't create yourself. You didn't make yourself. Why are you continuing to think that you can make yourself now? That doesn't make any sense. You didn't choose your parents. You can't choose your parents. You didn't choose where you're going to be born, or what language you would speak, or how much money your parents had when you were born, or any of those things. You had very little control over your beginnings. So it's a good thing to remember that you are indebted from the moment of your first breath, basically, to others, you know, and that means you're a communal person. You're part of a larger thing.
Right. There's no isolated incidents. There's no isolated actions.
That's right.
Consequences of actions can ripple out often in inexplicable and even incalculable ways. They can ripple out throughout your relational network. If I can speak a little businessy there. It can ripple out. What's interesting to me, is my thoughts on it, is looking at it as a Christian. It is interesting to me that the community that the moral imagination speaks of is generational.
Right.
And as a Christian, I think if somebody was like, you know, a scholar on the moral imagination, they could probably correct my obnoxiousness. But as a Christian, I look at it and I feel like that's like, yes, there's that, and there are other things you're in communion with, so to speak, or you're in relation with in some way that are also givens of your existence,
mm-hmm.
right? That you defy at your peril.
Mm-hmm.
So you are in relation to God, for instance, mm-hmm. as your creator, and as your, you know, as a Christian, as your father and your redeemer, right? You're in relation, and as everybody, as your creator and your judge.
Right.
Right? So there's the generational community is like a horizontal community, but there's also a vertical community.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Between you and the, like you hinted at that already, whether you knew it or not, Hodges. You hinted at that when you mentioned there's the church militant, but there's also the church triumphant.
Right.
Like those who have gone before us are not, I mean, there's a way to be, like you said, there's a way to be conservative and not Christian or even, you know, adhere to any one particular religion, although we'll get to point four in just one second.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way to be conservative and not be Christian. You could just say that, like, well, yes, my ancestors and those who went before. I mean, they're dead and gone, but, like, what they've done remains, and we should respect that. But for the Christian, those who have gone before you, they're not gone.
Right.
Right? They're still there, especially within the church. They're there communing with God in some mysterious way or still in communion with you because you're still all the church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's this vertical relation. There's also your relation with creation itself. The idea that you're enrooted in a natural order that's been created by God and manifest manifest the reality of God, but that's not what I meant. It's that thing in Romans where it says that His invisible attributes are clearly seen.
Yes.
Right? It manifests
in creation.
It manifests God in some way. Uh-huh. Right?
Right.
In Christian thought, that's where, like, the natural law, that's what the natural law is.
Sure.
Right? It shows how the created order is a result of divine mind and the divine of God's creative act. I haven't even thrown there, and I think this one is very important today. You have a relation with your body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, there's a relation. You are, in and of yourself, a relation between body and spirit, a breath and body at the same time.
That's right.
And there are givens to that relationship that you defy at your peril. And that's something that definitely today, with talks about sexuality and gender and issues going on, that's definitely something that needs to be reasserted. Because one of, like, the fundamental ideas of, like, a transgender ideology, and not just simply a transgender person, that's a different thing, but the ideas behind transgenderism,
mm-hmm.
I've argued this before, is that it is in some ways a denial of the body, of the givens of the body, and an acting like your relationship with your body is, it's some sort of force or threat that you have to dominate and overcome.
Well, and it's also a kind of an embrace of a Gnostic heresy that you are two parts, that there's a you and there's a your body.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think the Christian picture is that the two, the spirit, the breath, like you said, and the dust of the earth brought together, mm-hmm. are really one thing.
Yeah, they're integrated together.
They've been brought so closely together that you can't separate them. And that separating them would be death.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's what it is, isn't it?
Yes.
We're told that this wages of sin is death, and the death is the separation of the two parts that God brought together. He didn't intend for them to be brought separated. And that's why I think It's so important, this doctrine in 1 Corinthians 15 about the resurrection of the body, that not only was Jesus resurrected, but Jesus was the firstborn of the new creation of resurrected beings. That is, we're all going to be re-embodied.
Yeah.
And at the judgment, and that's when the thing that God put together will be reinstated properly, and final justice will be done. You see, we're not meant to be separated like that.
Right.
And so to allow ourselves to think, I feel like a different gender than I am, is a separation that I think is Gnostic. It's Gnostic. It's not Christian. Those are some interesting ideas, though, about community, that there's more than just community with the past or with the people of the present, people of the future. There's a community that you have, a relationship anyway, with God that builds community, but also a community, a communing, as it were, with nature, with the creation itself, including your own body. I like that.
Right. And the only other thing I would probably add is the communing of the church, which the church itself is unique. I mean, it's its own kind of community, and that has those who have gone before and those who are coming after in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's a community that's not bound by place or blood or...
Mm.
I mean, it's like there's neither, you know, there's neither Greek nor Jew. There's neither male nor female, bond nor free. There's all those distinctions that usually form communal relations are lost in the, well, they're not considered as the thing that binds you together. What binds you together is Christ, the living head.
Right.
And that's it's a community. It's a different kind of community.
Yeah.
Just one that binds the present with the dead and then those who are unborn. It binds you, like I said, to the church triumphant. It binds you to a history. We are bound to a history of people from like North Africa and like Cappadocia, where Turkey is now, even though our physical ancestors may never have come from there.
Right.
Or they may come from there like so far back that it's almost meaningless to us.
So maybe this is another way that we can make a distinction, hopefully a helpful distinction, between a conservative mind and the Christian mind. Mm-hmm. That is, the idyllic might be a kind of more individualistic thing or a very narrow view of a community, mm-hmm. where the moral imagination would say, no, you have to be in touch with all that have gone before you and all that come after you. But then the Christian would say, even further than that, then it's the church body that is the living organism that is the picture of real community, mm-hmm. that is the church triumphant and the church militant. So there's a Christian, I don't know.
Addition or enrichment?
Enrichment, yeah, fine-tuning or something, an additional element that makes that conservatism truly rich and fully Christian.
Yeah, I don't have another word for it like I did with the other two, but there is a kind of enriching, tweaking, and fine-tuning that a Christian vision does when it looks at that idea of community.
I think there's the right understanding of the fifth commandment comes in here too, because honor your father and mother. It's good to honor your parents. God is telling us to honor our parents, our biological parents there, certainly. But I think he's also saying, honor those who've gone before you, those who brought you into being more culturally, say, or technologically, or in community, in the church, and so on. In other words, your spiritual parents or your cultural parents as well as your biological parents. And it's the first commandment with a promise. Mm-hmm. It says, so that it might go well with you. That somehow being aware of and honoring those who have gone before you will make your life a far better life.
It's like having a spirit, like the idea of community, whether it's conservative or this more Christian fine-tuned version, it's like having a spiritual vision of things.
Uh-huh.
You see, you understand there is a world outside of your immediate present world.
Mm-hmm.
There is a past that has gone before you and has delivered things, and it is a given of your existence, and you ignore it at your peril. There is a future of future generations and peoples. They may not be your kids, but they're going to be somebody's kids. You're leaving a world behind you. And that's also an inescapable given of existence,
right? It's not just being aware of those who've gone before you and honoring them. It's how are you acting in your life now to honor those who are coming after you?
Yes. So it's like recognizing this thing, there's something larger you're a part of that you ignore at your peril.
Right.
And where Christianity fine tunes it is it directly plugs in God, specifically God the Trinity, but also the church that he's founded through Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's a different, that's a tweaking. What would you say, I think you've mentioned it in passing, but what would you say is the idyllic imagination's counterpoint to this idea of community?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly individualism like we've been experiencing, I think, in our day in spades. In fact, so much so that we are kind of swinging back toward a desire for community again, even in our, amongst those who are not considered Christian or conservative, for that matter. But individualism, the striving of the individual to be all that he can be on his own, I think, is the idyllic mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so community is okay, but it's not essential. What's essential to the idyllic imagination is the fulfillment of the, I don't know, appetites, desires, directions, gifts, all of that, of the individual for his own sake and his own sort of established reputation and power and money and all those things.
Yeah, there are two words that came to mind. One I thought of just now. The other one I thought of a little earlier when you mentioned the idyllic imagination's version of this in passing. The first was the idea of rather than community, they have the idea of progress.
Right.
Right, that what matters is not recognizing your continuity, that there's this world larger than you that you have to take an account of or else, you know, it'll go bad. Like you ignore this at your peril. Rather than that, what is there is a constant escaping from the past, from its benightedness, from its shackles, from its flaws, from its failures. Because remember, we're either fundamentally good or we're blank slates and can be made inherently good if we just get our ducks in a row and we get all our stuff together and we can learn from the past, but we learn how not to be the past.
Right.
Right. It's a purely negative knowledge. Well, here's why they were stupid and primitive, and here's how we're going to do it better.
Right.
Maybe if you're a little bit wiser, you sort of acknowledge, you know, that like, and then, you know, in 100 years, people will think we're stupid and primitive, but they'll get it even better and so on and so forth. But instead of community, you have progress.
Right. And I think if you have, you know, the more you're surrounded by technology, the more you find that compelling, that notion compelling, because, I mean, all you got to do is look at the refrigerator, for example, that we use now and compare it to the one that we used 70 years ago, and you think it's so much more efficient, it's so much more improved.
Measure your milk and send an email to the grocery store when you're like...
Yes, it's astonishing what it'll do now that used to be called an ice box, where we took a big chunk of ice and we stuck it in the box and we put our things in it, you know,
in a Germanic description.
That's right, very practical. Or, you know, computers, certainly. The computer you own right now is already obsolete.
Yes.
It already is. If you've purchased it, it's gone. It's over with because that's how fast.
As soon as you drove it off the lot, it didn't just depreciate. It like immediately.
That's right. It was already old fashioned. So things on that level are constantly improving, aren't they? You could say the same thing about automobiles, certainly. Any of the other technological advances we've had, what we can do on the internet now that we couldn't do with our, you probably aren't even old enough to remember those modems that we had to begin with.
That made the loud noise.
Did you ever have one?
I'm old enough to remember it. Yeah.
Well, you used to plug it into your telephone line, and you'd run it through your telephone line, and it would have a...
That would help you if you picked up the phone.
Yes, right.
Somebody was trying to get on the internet. Your ear got broken, and their connection got disconnected, so it was all just a mess.
It's really come a long way, hasn't it? So the more you see things like that, the electric light bulb, for heaven's sake, is, you know, the ability to heat and cool our houses, all of the things that we live with that we sort of take for granted nowadays have improved so much in our lifetimes that it's hard to imagine that we aren't progressing in every way, you know, all the time. But the reality is we're not necessarily progressing in every way. We may be progressing technologically, but are we progressing morally?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. And are we progressing in our ability to care for one another, for our ability to glorify God? I don't know that we are. But that those things seem, it's the idyllic imagination seems so much more plausible when we're surrounded by technology that is constantly improving.
Yeah, it's a leftover of Enlightenment thinking, that if we're progressing in these ways, we must be progressing in every way. You still hear it today, by the way. Steve Pinker, with his Enlightenment Now, committed the exact same error, that somehow because we have democracy, iPhones, and air conditioning, some of that means we're vastly superior to those superstitious medievals and stuff like that. I thought progress was a good antithesis to community, because at least the moral imagination's definition of community, because its definition of community is not just you're in relation with people, because in that sense it's just, you know, you have friends, then you have community.
Right.
But it's this idea of generational community. I guess another word for it might be continuity, that there's a continuity between you and the past and the future that ties you to certain responsibilities. And progress may like the idea of being tied to the future, always moving forward, but it would not like the idea of being tied to the past, like somehow you have to do due diligence and due reverence to that, that the past never leaves you.
Yes.
You know, the progress always wants to escape the past and get away from it.
Right.
And so the other word I thought of besides progress is like, what is it progressing towards and what's kind of animating it? And that's the idea of emancipation.
Uh-huh.
Right, which again would be against the idea of community, because community, as defined by the moral imagination, means you are beholden to certain things.
Right.
Right. You're beholden to a past that has given you what you have, and you're beholden to a future that's going to receive what you give.
Yes.
And that puts certain obligations upon you, and emancipation just recoils at that idea of obligations. You know, take me, you know, get me away from all this, you know, this past that foists things upon me, or a future that I just won't have kids.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I'll just, and who cares? You know, my decisions are none of your business, so why should it matter how it affects anything else? It's this desire for that isolation, an isolation of maybe, you know, not from people, but from incidents, you know, an isolation from the idea that somehow your choices have a consequence outside of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Definitely want to be emancipated from that. Mm-hmm. So I guess idyllic imagination would have at its heart progress towards emancipation. Progress and emancipation.
And emancipation from any kind of restriction.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Certainly restrictions of responsibility. But even the restrictions, as we were saying a minute ago, restrictions like the limitations of the physical body, or the limitations of gravity, or the limitations of time.
Yes.
We don't like those things. We want to break free from those. It's a kind of a desire to be autonomous.
Yes.
Again, back to that whole idea of being my own judge, my own evaluator.
Yeah.
And nobody else can do that for me. I want to do that myself.
And it also makes it where it's not just...
It breaks community by definition, doesn't it?
It's not just a strict individualism that could lead to the breakdown of community, but even collectivism could lead to a breakdown of community, because collectivism is always in the sense of, if we organize ourselves in this certain way and pattern, will bring about full emancipation in some way. It's still in the service of like progressing forward. The only way we can progress forward is either we atomize ourselves so thoroughly that everybody can't hurt anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody like respects all their rights and self-interest, or we simplify and brutalize everybody into a mass that's easier to manage, and we can bring about the emancipation that we so desire and need. So let's look, that would be like...
At least for some.
At least for some,
case,
right?
The mass doesn't get emancipation, but the leaders that can somehow herd that mass maybe can experience it closer to emancipation.
And for me, that's important because like the Christian view of this that I think also adds another specific tweak to it is that the Christian acknowledges the larger forces around the individual person are the larger realities that the individual person is necessarily in relation with. And at the same time acknowledges the individual person as a unique, non-repeatable, valuable, full of dignity creation.
Right.
It doesn't see the individual person as irrelevant to all the larger forces. You know, a true Christian vision is not a slave to the past, especially if your past, you inherit something that you look at and you're like, this is sinful, like this is not good. You know, it gives you grounds to, like, you know, critique the past or judge the past.
That's right.
Offer a better future, a different future.
Yeah, to be in touch with the past doesn't mean to simply blindly accept the past. Chesterton, of course, does a good distinction for us between tradition and traditionalism, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tradition
being an acceptance of an appreciation of the past, allowing them to have a say
right.
in what we do today. But traditionalism is this idea that we just blindly do whatever they did in the past and never correct it.
It's dead.
Well, that's no good.
Right. They call it a living tradition. And the idea of a living tradition is that you treat it like what Chesterton called it, a democracy of the dead. You're giving a voice to your elders.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the only voice.
No, that's right. And where they're mistaken, we should correct them.
Right, but they have a voice.
But they have a voice.
So it's a living thing. So,
isn't it?
Yep. So moving on, I guess, I mean, we could go on for days, I feel like.
Sure, there's lots to say, isn't there?
But to that fourth point about religion, now what is it? What does moral imagination mean by religion?
Right. The way to put it is that there's no culture without cult.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the culture is based on a set of religious, really religious, I say that with a small r, assumptions about the nature of God, the nature of man, the purpose of life, all those things, the essentials about life and liberty and what goodness is. And what beauty is. So we can't actually have a kind of community, a real community, like we talked about in the third one, mm-hmm. Without agreeing on some kind of religious assumptions. Mm-hmm. So the word cult, you know, is the root of the word cultivate
mm-hmm.
and the word culture. And the word agriculture. Mm-hmm. And all of those things kind of go together. So there's a very close-knit bond between growing things, how things grow mm-hmm. in the ground, and eating, and the community that we have in raising food for ourselves. But there's also, at the source of that agricultural idea, the idea that we're doing something for the glory of God, that there's a higher purpose to it than simply filling our bellies. Our appetites are only one of the things that we have to address, and in fact, not even the highest thing. So what religion does is give us a hierarchy of loves, hierarchy of values, if you will. And we have to be in unison with others about that hierarchy of values if we ever want to have a culture.
Yeah, I think this part is the hardest part to explain, not because it's gibberish, but because it touches at something so deeply, intimately fundamental that everybody intuitively knows what we're talking about, even if our words are, like, really, really hard to try and explain it. Richard Weaver in Ideas Have Consequences, I think it was in the, well, not the introduction, but in the first chapter, I think,
mm-hmm.
Talked about something called, in Unsentimental Sentiments, that was there.
Yeah, that's the first chapter.
He talked about something called the metaphysical dream.
Right.
It was his term for this thing that religion serves as like an embodiment and transmission of in some way.
Mm-hmm.
He said that before you can even begin to reason, reason is based on this thing called a metaphysical dream that sets the very categories of reason, that establishes what can be reasoned about and what can't, and how reason even works. And what he meant was, it's kind of hard to explain what he meant because he wrote a whole chapter trying to explain what he meant. It's like this fundamental, meaningful narrative and vision of the world. It's like a total vision of the world. You could say, well, you mean like a worldview? I'm like, well, yeah, but it's not always like laid, like, you know, when you go to worldview class, it's like systematically laid out. Like, you know, James Sire's Universe Next Door had like his 8 points or something of like what a worldview answers and all that.
Right,
things.
Right.
Well, sometimes that might not be laid out. It may just be an intuitive sense of like, it's an intuitive sense that existence is meaningful.
I think that people are unaware of their assumptions. In other words, these are subconscious assumptions sometimes, this metaphysical dream.
Yeah.
We act out of them, but we don't necessarily know consciously what they are.
Yeah, it's this intuitive sense that life is not just there. Life is also meaningful. It's value-laden.
That's right.
Right?
That's
and thus our actions matter and so on and so forth. And what religion does, what cult does, is like I said, it tries to embody and transmit what that value meaning is some way to people. It tries to give them, here's, you know, why I think why Weaver would say it's like, why is it a grounding for reason? You can't even really reason properly until you have that, is because it's the metaphysical dream that tells you why reasoning even matters in the first place.
That's right.
And what even constitutes irrationality and rationality in the first place. So it's like the religion gives you, here is like bedrock, baseline, meaning and value that you've always known and your gut is there, and we are, by our ritual and our ceremony and by all these sort of bindings we put upon you. I think that's where the root of like the Latin idea of the word religion comes from, is to bind yourself
something.
You know, the oaths you take, the promises you make, the ceremonies you partake in, all these are ways of you yourself embodying and acting out and giving your due respect to that larger, meaningful value manifold or apparatus or whatever, or narrative or whatever you want to call it, that's out there.
Sure.
Words fail, but it's like that sense of the intuitive sense that life is not just, it's not random, it's not chaotic, it's actually fundamentally meaningful.
Right. And there is the assumption that life is somehow not only meaningful, but better than the alternative, that life has an inherent value. And so it's worth preserving, for example, it's worth defending. But it also, the religious part of it actually tells you when life is worth giving up, right? Because your life individually, let's say it this way. If you assume that there is something after death that's of value, then you know that your life is extremely important and other people's lives are extremely important by extension, but that they're not the most important thing. Because there's something maybe that's worth dying for.
And this idea of religion in the moral imagination is that religion is the thing that sort of codifies and embodies and articulates and transmits what are the right loves, what are the right values, what is the true meaning and the true values that you ought to have.
And now we get to the point that Burke and T.S. Eliot both make, that is, that there is what they called the wardrobe of a moral imagination. And that is the thing that you put on in order to be able to convey and understand and live out what your cult is, what your religion is, what your moral imagination is. And Eliot and Burke both would say that poetry is the wardrobe of a moral imagination. And of course, by that he means any kind of art, but especially language, art. So that we write poems, we write stories, we write epic poems, we write novels, we communicate with one another by way of art, by way of metaphor, by way of creativity, in order to be able to convey the essences of this meaning you're talking about, of the cult. The cult conveys the purposes of it by way of, as you say, ceremony, but the ceremony is something that you do as in a kind of an agreement. The means of communication about the agreement, what is it we agree to, is embodied, like you say, in Hamlet. It's embodied in, you know, Dante. It's embodied in self-portraits of Rembrandt. It's embodied in the Mozart operas. It's embodied in all of the artwork that we have crafted, all the poetry that we've made. It's embodied in the four quartets of Eliot. He intended for us to hear those quartets and to feel and experience the depths of the cult that he's calling us to. When I use the word cult, I hope they understand.
Yeah, well, you're trying to connect the religious sense to the culture. There's a link there between the two, which is why we're talking.
That's right.
You know, we mention religion and suddenly we bring up art. What does that have to do with it? Well, because art is the embodiment. I mean, we have a book called Art and Ideas. It might even be better to, the more apt phrase would be art and loves.
Yeah.
Art is the embodiment of the loves, the embodiment of the values and the meanings.
Right. Look at this painting and know that this is what was loved, and this is what you might learn to love yourself. And in doing so, you're joining into that community. You're arranging your loves in the same sort of order that that the community has had in the past, connects you up with the past and connects you up to those who love those things in your own generation. And thus, you want to be able to pass down to the next generation those things that are profound and true and deep, and they are going to be done in some sort of metaphoric way. You can't get around the fact that you have to embody these things in order for them to be communicated. In the same way that we're talking right now on this podcast, the truly profound things have to be put into words and communicated to others. And while I don't think of our podcast as a bit of poetry, it's a call to appreciate those things that really are the communications that we're talking about, the great works of the past. And so Burke said, in order for you to be able to understand this moral imagination, you have to be willing to read the poetry and make sense of the art and listen to the music and understand what it is that past generations are handing down to you by way of these physical manifestations.
Yeah, that's interesting. The reason it's interesting is because it's, the wardrobe of moral imagination is something I've heard many times before.
Hmm.
We even had it in one of our, what is the center all about kind of spiels.
Yes,
at one
yes.
point. And Hodges, I never understood what that meant.
I'm sorry.
Because I was like, the wardrobe of what does that even mean? Like, it was like how you guss up the moral imagination. Like, what are you talking about?
Sure.
But the wardrobe of moral imagination, what you mean is, not what you mean, but what it means is that it's how you embody the metaphysical dream.
Right.
It's how you dress up the metaphysical dream so in order to articulate and transmit it.
That's right.
Right. So the wardrobe of a moral imagination is the art, is the embodiment of the meaning and the loves.
That's right. The conservative mind allows for, in fact, knows the value of, more than allows for, actually desires to have and to experience the veils and the drapery and the wardrobe.
Yeah, what else are you going to call it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying the clothing that goes on the outside. We can strip away. This is the sort of, the opposite of it is the idyllic imagination wants, in a sense, to strip away anything that stands between us and the object that we desire.
Yes.
You see? And so that means that the idyllic imagination is very unwilling to allow any kind of tradition to stand in the way.
Right.
But what they don't know, what they don't understand, is that it's by way of that tradition or by way of that wardrobe, that artwork, that poetry, that the thing they long for gets conveyed to them. Mm. You see? It can't be had, in a sense, nakedly. So if there's an animal desire for sexual drive, for example, the wardrobe of the moral imagination writes love poetry and celebrates marriage as a ceremony, you see. Mm-hmm. But the idyllic imagination says, get the marriage and the responsibilities and all the commitment stuff out of the way. And because it not only does it call me to commit to things that I'm not ready to commit to, but it also stands in the way of my getting immediate satisfaction of my desire, see. So the wise are the ones that say, wait a minute, you can't actually be fulfilled in your sexual desire if you don't go through marriage or if you don't go through the love ritual and learn what a romance is. And I mean that in the medieval sense, mm-hmm. that your choices are important and that they can be wrong, they can go badly, and there are dire consequences. And this life is a drama, in a sense. This life is a play that where things happen, the real things happen.
Yeah.
So, but we think that we can have the thing we want without actually having to deal with the coverings that we've laid on it.
Yeah.
But the reality is, it's the coverings that make it possible for us to... It's like this. If I want... Here's a glass. It happens to be empty. But if I had some water and I put it in there, I could drink the water. But if I just had the water, think about the water without any kind of form around it, right? It would be useless to me if I wanted to drink. I could hardly get a drop of it into my mouth. So it's actually by way of the glass... Think of the glass as the wardrobe. Mm-hmm. It's all actually by way of the glass that it's possible for me to have this, the benefit of the water.
Right. If we're looking for the idyllic counterpoint to religion, I'm going to go all the way back to early podcast days and say the counterpoint, the idyllic counterpoint to religion would be immediacy.
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
They don't want mediation, which is what religion is. It's a mediation.
Exactly.
And the point you're raising is super important because it's like, the conservative instinct is a desire for some kind of form as a means of transmitting whatever the good is.
Right.
Coming.
That's right.
And but the key is it's not that they desire it for some subjective reason. Well, I just like it. You know, I just like that it's this way. It's my own. No, it's because there's some instinctive understanding that if you don't give it to me in this form, you can't give it to me.
That's right. That's right. It can't be done.
If you don't put the water in a glass, you can pour it out all you want. It's just going to go on the floor and in my lap. Maybe I could try and lap some up in my fingers or hands. But if you put it in a glass, solid, you know, structured, oppressive, hierarchical, patriarchal glass, if you put it in there, then I can actually...
Real definitions.
Real definition and edges and contours. That's and it's right. Substantive and solid. Yeah. Then I can actually drink the water.
Exactly.
So
it's the point.
That's the idea. It's this, the opposite of religion in the idyllic imagination would be immediacy, right? Or immediation, if you want to be more fancy about
That's right.
It.
That's exactly what it is.
And you can already see, well, I mean, you should obviously see this, but here's where the Christian sort of take and spin and stuff of this, the moral imagination's idea of religion is simply that it gives this notion of religion a very specific content.
Right.
And that is the Trinitarian, Christocentric theology and philosophy of Christianity, which has its own metaphysical dream, if you want to call it, but it has all the Christian central doctrines of like creation, incarnation, Trinity, redemption, which includes in it the idea of the fall and all that stuff. Those things are supposed to be not just interesting checkpoints to make sure you're not, you know, a Mormon or something like that, or a way for you to tell atheists that they're going to hell or something like that. The reason they're there, amongst other things, is to, well, oh gosh, how am I going to say this? I was about to say they're there to give you art, but that's not entirely what I'm trying to say. They are the value. They are the things that shape your values and your meaning.
Right.
They are the value and meaning. That's where you find it. You find value and meaning in the Trinitarian life of the infinite, eternal, personal God, who has revealed himself in Scripture, but in his latter days through his Son, who is the second person of the Trinity incarnate.
Right.
All that I just said in there is just a fecund landscape for all kinds of, you know, culture.
Yes.
Right? Not just church services and catechisms, though catechisms are nice, and you know, Christianese, but a culture can grow up out of that.
That's right. That's right. In the same way that a marriage can beget children, can make children, and proper understanding of the ground and the seed and so on can bear fruit, and you can have corn or wheat or whatever. In the same way, we can grow in our understanding of who God is by taking that invisible God, the God that truly is not tangible, except for the fact of the incarnation. I mean, the triune God, that God. But you can see him if you drape him in the wardrobe. See? So the wardrobe, that is in this case poetry, words, make it possible for us to comprehend this invisible shape.
Yeah.
It's like, think of the invisible man. And then he puts a coat on.
Yeah.
You see the coat walk through the room, right? Well, you can see where he is now because he's got this coat on. But right. If you took the coat off, you wouldn't have any idea, right? Right. But the coat actually gives you the outline of his figure, you know, where his arm is and where his shoulder is and where his head might be and so on.
Right. And I'm already thinking, like, in the specific Christian sense, there are two very specific wardrobes of that moral imagination. If you go to two specific times, one is Christ. who is definitely, you know, he is the invisible God made visible, right?
Right.
In human form.
Right.
But then also the church itself.
Yes.
Is supposed to be that.
We embody him, don't we?
Yeah, the coat on Christ, basically.
Yes, that's like, right.
So him still walking around. We're supposed to be shaped and contoured to him so people can see him walking around, so to speak, still amongst them.
That's the idea. So that when the world looks at us in our churches, in our marriages, they see him. That's exactly right. And I think what Eliot would say is that the invisible God makes himself known by way of language himself. So he speaks to us. In fact, he's even called the Word. So words are to find their definitions in him. Mm-hmm. Right? So the way we use words suddenly can be in keeping with him or not. So it's possible to be blasphemous, for example. You see, you can say things that are simply not true of him. But it's still in the way of the Word that we get to know who he is. And that's a mystery bigger than any of us. It's beyond us. But it's not completely incomprehensible. Yeah. It's the opposite, isn't it? It's because he's Word that we can comprehend, or at least apprehend, something true about him.
Yeah.
So the moral imagination gets passed on by way of poetry.
And it's a word that, this is super important because this is for my deconstructive and post-structuralist friends out there. It's a word that reveals itself in concretion in some way.
Mm-hmm.
God spoke, but when he spoke, his word created a creation.
Right.
Right? And when he spoke to, you know, Moses and Abraham and all the, you know, Jewish fathers and stuff like that, all the patriarchs back then, they wrote it down so it could be transmitted, and they embodied it in ceremony and in temple and stuff like that.
Right.
And when the word came, he came and became flesh. And what he said and what he did was written down, and then a church was instituted to be more flesh. It's not the sense of, like, the reason I said deconstructive post-structuralism is because they like to make hay of, like, well, which is better, the spoken word or the written word? There's all kinds of problems. As a Christian, you do not have the luxury to pick between those two.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? That's a false dichotomy to act like one is better than the other. As Chesterton said, if the incarnation teaches us anything, it's that the good tends towards incarnation.
Hmm.
It tends towards becoming physical and concrete.
Right, right. Yeah, we don't need to. The Unitarian way is to make things less concrete and more abstract.
Yes.
And more general.
Yes.
In hopes to get at the realities of things. The theosophy is kind of this way too,
mm-hmm.
where you try to get the essences of things, and in doing so, you lose all detail, you lose all distinction amongst things. Everything becomes sort of rolls itself into one, or very few anyway, elements. But in doing so, you lose the marvels of the distinctions of everything that God has made. And so, I think Chesterton's right. If it's like Christ, then it becomes increasingly concrete. It wants to be manifest in a specific way. And any Christian poet has had to wrestle with this, where he writes of a line and refines the line, actually makes it more and more concrete until it becomes something like the parables, something like, you know, I am the vine and you are the branches. You think that's as specific as you can be, right? That's so technical. It's so right there physically in front of you. And yet it, through its very specificity, gives you the particulars of the invisible relationship between Christ and the church. So all of these things, I think it's important to let's just recap a little bit here.
Yeah.
The fallenness of man, the sinfulness of man, interior sinfulness of man, helps understand why it is that its opposite is rife with difficulty. That if you don't believe that man is fallen, you turn your eyes to systems outside of yourself to address evil. And in doing so, you can never actually fix the problem. Mm-hmm. No matter how well how good you are at crafting a new law or a new government or a new economic system or remake the church or remake the neighborhood, community center or whatever you're working on where people meet together, no matter how good you are at restructuring the outward world, you can't actually get at the key of the problem, because the key of the problem is in my heart, is in your heart.
Yes.
So that's the first thing. The second thing then is that the world is tragic. The idyllic imagination says, no, the world isn't tragic. We can make the world into the thing we want it to be here. If we can just fix these things I was talking about a minute ago, then we can have utopia here. There's no reason why we should think that our systems have to be flawed. We can keep tweaking them until they're perfect.
And the ones who tell us that they're flawed must somehow be benefiting from the system, from the status quo.
Oh, yes. There are all sorts of rationalizations for why you don't want to continue to fight this fight with us, this progressivist fight with us. Mm-hmm. You must be one of those that's making a living off of the flawed system. Well, then the third thing is a desire for community, but that desire for community for the conservative says, I want to see myself as a part of a much larger community than just my own generation. But the progressivist says, if everything in the past is worse than it is now, I don't want to be a part of that. I want to be broken free from that. I want to be cut free from the past so that I can be free to do as I please. That seems very optimistic. And the fact is, you bump into the need for community within your own generation.
Yeah.
And then you start saying, well, I don't want to be in community with you or you or you, and definitely not you.
Yes, I want to exclude all these excluders.
That's right. They're all excluders. I don't want to be in community with them. And what do you find? I can only be happy when I'm a completely individual, when I'm set aside, I'm set apart from everybody else. I'm not called on by anybody else to be responsible. I'm not responsible for them. They're not responsible for me. I want to be free from all those ties. But then finally, a recognition that there has to be a common understanding of what the purpose of life is, and that comes through religion or through what we call cult. And that cult is the source of culture, and culture is the source of bearing fruit. And so it's not surprising that anybody who embraces an idyllic imagination ends up not having as many children, or becoming an advocate for euthanasia, or for abortion, or for getting married late, or getting married not having children at all. We're not even getting married. What's the purpose of marriage, right? We don't need all that stuff. To fulfill myself is the goal. I don't need to be in touch with those things. But religion tells you, hang on, your goal really is to be a part of this bigger community, including having children, and that bearing children makes a difference for the future. You're actually in charge to a degree of what comes after you. So your actions in your life really have a deep, profound effect on the lives of those who come after you. All of that together can be a source for tremendous conflict in the world. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous conflict. So that people, if they just assume the wrong thing about those four ill elements, they will never come to having a community together. The fact that the fabric of our community today in our United States is still sort of holding on barely, and in Europe it's fraying maybe even further, is a tribute really to our humanity in spite of ourselves, because we don't live out that Nietzschean nihilism to a perfect degree. We don't that pure individualism to a perfect degree. We do find that we want to have relationships and family and all that to some degree. So but I think understanding what the moral imagination is and the idyllic imagination could help at least begin some debates or discussions amongst people, recognizing those assumptions.
Well, we could keep going, but let's pull the emergency brake.
Yeah, sure.
Call it a day, and get to recommendations.
Okay.
I will, since I am
first.
Since I'm not as well read up on moral imagination stuff as perhaps you are, I will recommend a romance.
Mm.
How about that?
Wonderful.
One of my all-time favorite romances, The Faerie Queen.
Ah.
By Edmund Spenser, written in the late 1500s. Good old English Renaissance writing. Spenser was an oddball because, on the one hand, he was firmly Protestant and English and Renaissance-y, and so he had all the usual sort of perhaps unfair negative stereotypes about the medieval world.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, he was a great lover of the Romantic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote what is effectively a Renaissance Protestant romance in his own stanza style, which was The Faerie Queen. And we got six books. It was supposed to be in 12, but he died before he could finish it. So we got in six books. And just read the first one. Everyone, if you haven't read it, it's difficult because the way he does language is very, very old school. It was old school for his time. I tell people the way people at his time would have approached his version of English is kind of like how we would approach, you know, reading somebody from the late 19th century. You know, we would be able to read it. We would just recognize it as old. Well, Spenser's peers would have been able to read the English he was writing in, but they just would have recognized it as old. Well, we're even further removed, so sometimes the language can be a little intimidating, but the great solution to that is to just read it out loud. Like, that's what I found has always fixed it. So my recommendation to you is to find yourself a good copy of The Faerie Queen, Book 1, and sit down and read it out loud, and for goodness sake, enjoy a tale of a princess and a knight on a journey to kill a dragon, and all the ridiculousness that happens on the way before they even get to the dragon.
Wonderful. And I will recommend T.S. Eliot's poem East Coker from the Four Quartets.
All right.
The middle section of it, second section of it, has one of my favorite bits in there talking about the moral imagination being conveyed by poetry. He says this, I'll probably botch it up, but it's something like this. The wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands, we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Our only health is the disease, if we obey the dying nurse whose constant care is not to please, but to remind of our and Adam's curse, and that to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. It's a picture of our need for surgery and the kindness of God in the hands of Jesus, being the wounded surgeon. He's the surgeon, but he himself is bleeding, if you see.
Yeah.
And the picture of this idea that if we're going to be healed, we have to confess that we really are in need of healing. If we're to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. To be able to grasp that as well as he does and to convey it is just one tiny part of his massive accomplishment in the Four Quartets. But I recommend the Four Quartets in general and then East Coker in particular.
All right. Well, this has been From the Center. We thank you guys for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.
God bless you all.